western Minnesota with blustery northwest winds up to 40 miles per hour. Snow tapering off tomorrow morning with highs tomorrow mid to upper 20s.
The reality is Putin doesn't want a ceasefire. Putin doesn't want a negotiation. Putin doesn't want peace. Putin wants Ukraine.
The Trump administration says Ukraine-Russia peace talks are making progress.
But many experts remain skeptical.
For Tuesday, November 25th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Ahead, we'll talk to Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, who's facing threats from the Pentagon and the Trump White House.
And we'll take a step back to try and explain why exactly healthcare premiums are so costly.
For example, health plans often might not cover pregnancy or even prescription drugs.
Plus, youth sports have gotten more and more monetized and top-heavy.
The latest trend, private companies making big money streaming youth hockey.
I was just told this last weekend that if I live stream my child's hockey game, my kid's team will be penalized.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. President Trump says he's directed members of his administration to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainians, this in hopes of finalizing a peace deal between the two nations. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports.
Trump said in a post on social media that Special Envoy Steve Witkoff will meet with Putin in Moscow, and Secretary of the Army Dan Driscoll will meet with the Ukrainians. The president says he won't meet with Putin or Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky until a peace deal is in its final stages. Trump was supposed to meet with Putin last month in Hungary, but the meeting was scrapped with Trump announcing new sanctions on Russia. The ongoing war between Ukraine and Russia has been a point of frustration for Trump, who claims he's ended several other wars this year. He repeatedly says the war between Ukraine and Russia should have been easier to end. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, the White House.
Tens of millions of Americans are beginning their Thanksgiving travel today, with highways, airports, and train stations expected to be packed. AAA is forecasting 82 million people will travel, an increase of 1.6 million from last year's holiday. 90% of the travel will be by car. Patrick DeHaan with Gas Buddy says gasoline prices are not a factor.
We're seeing the stock market fluctuate. Job losses have amounted this year to the most significant since 2022, but it's not all bad news. Gas prices relatively low. For their part, 74% of respondents to our survey said gas prices are not impacting their travel plans this year, but still, there's a lot of jitter within consumers.
The FAA says when it comes to air travel, this will be the busiest Thanksgiving in 15 years, with 360,000 flights scheduled between yesterday and next Tuesday. DOT Secretary Sean Duffy says air traffic control staffing levels are returning to normal. The 102-year-old partnership between the U.S. military and scouting could be coming to an end. NPR's Graham Smith reports Defense Secretary Hegseth is moving to withdraw support from the organization formerly known as the Boy Scouts.
In a draft report to Congress reviewed by NPR, Hegseth says supporting the Scout Jamboree next summer would harm national security, that scarce resources can't be diverted from border security work. He also condemns scouting for promoting DEI, saying it rebranded to be, quote, genderless and attack boy-friendly spaces. Another draft memo obtained by NPR orders the branches to bar scout troops from meeting on military bases worldwide and says that DOD will stop offering advanced rank to Eagle Scouts who enlist. The Pentagon refused to offer comment on what they called, quote, leaked documents that they cannot authenticate and which may not have been finalized. Graham Smith, NPR News.
This is NPR. Police in southwestern Virginia are searching for a missing high school football coach who they say is wanted on 5 counts of child pornography possession and other charges related to soliciting a minor. Last week, police went to the home of Travis Turner from Wise County, Virginia, and discovered he was missing. Before he disappeared from the team that he was coaching was undefeated and advanced deep into the state playoffs. The team played its latest playoff game without him. The school district says it's cooperating with law enforcement. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says she will not run for re-election following months of high-profile clashes with President Trump. WAMU's Alex Coma has more.
Bowser said Tuesday she felt she'd accomplished everything she set out to do since winning the job back in 2014. That includes securing a new stadium deal for the Washington Commanders and overseeing a surge in housing construction in the city. But her tenure was also dogged by President Trump's frequent interventions in the city's affairs, which she referenced in a video announcing her decision.
We also brought our city back from the ravages of a global pandemic and summoned our collective strength to stand tall against bullies who threaten our very autonomy.
Advisors say Bowser's weariness with dealing with Trump, who took over the city's police force this summer, contributed to her decision to decline a re-election bid. For NPR News, I'm Alex Coma in Washington, D.C.
A relative of White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt has been arrested by ICE agents just outside of Boston earlier this month. Member station WBUR is reporting the woman is now in ICE custody in Louisiana. Michael Leavitt, Carolyn Leavitt's older brother, had a relationship with the woman. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's 5:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to those who will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Snow tonight, tapering off tomorrow morning, with highs tomorrow in the mid to upper 20s.
PR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Arizona Senator Mark Kelly is facing the threat of a potential military court-martial. This after he and other Democratic lawmakers with national security backgrounds put out a video reminding active duty troops that they do not have to follow illegal orders. President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth were quick to criticize. Trump posted on social media that the video was, quote, seditious behavior that was, quote, punishable by death, though the White House later walked back the execution threat. Senator Kelly is a retired Navy captain, and therefore the Department of Defense does have the technical right to call him back to active service and put him under a court-martial. The Pentagon threatened that move when it announced it was investigating Kelly for, quote, serious allegations of misconduct. And according to a spokesperson for Kelly, the FBI is also currently attempting to schedule interviews with the lawmakers who made the video. Senator Kelly, for his part, has responded with a statement saying, quote, if this is meant to intimidate me and other members of Congress from doing our jobs and holding this administration accountable, it won't work. For more on all of this, we are joined by Arizona Democrat Mark Kelly. Thanks for being on the line.
You're welcome.
A lot of people have seen the video. What specifically compelled you to put it out now?
Well, there's a number of us that served in the U.S. military and the intelligence community that, you know, we're talking about some of the actions that the administration has taken with regards to sending troops into U.S. cities. The president has talked about sending troops into more cities to use cities as training grounds, which means you're going to be using U.S. citizens for training of the U.S. military. We're concerned about that. Mm-hmm. And you add on top of that, that here's a president who has previously said in his first administration, he has talked about shooting protesters in the legs. In 2016, he talked about killing the families of terrorists. And when told that that would be illegal, that would be an illegal order, he said that the military would not refuse to follow his orders. So the group of us were concerned, and we wanted to send a very simple message out, something that's consistent with the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that you do not have to follow, and you should not follow, illegal orders. So we said, follow the law. Donald Trump responded with, kill them. So, Scott, I think what he's doing here is he's declaring that loyalty to the Constitution is punishable by death.
Why do you think specifically, like you said, and like you've said several times in the wake of this, you were just stating a fact, stating the law. Why do you think Trump and Hegseth responded the way that they did?
I don't know. I think any other president would have responded, if they responded at all, with two words, of course. Mm-hmm. And then maybe followed it up with, of course, members of the military should not follow illegal orders. But you know, Trump is, you know, who he is. And He's certainly outrageous and unpredictable. I don't think he understands the Constitution. I'm not so sure Pete Hegseth does either. Neither of them seem to understand the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because we recited what is in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and now he wants to court-martial me under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It just doesn't make any sense.
A big story of the first term was that Trump had those instincts, like you said, and it's been documented that there were a lot of people in positions of power in the military, whether it was Secretary Mattis, Secretary Esper, others, who stopped him, who said, no, you can't do that. Do you have any faith that Secretary Hegseth would ever say, no, Mr. President, you're wrong?
Zero faith that he would do that. I mean, he just seems to, you know, react in whatever way the president wants him to. And that's where the whole system starts to break down.
Mm-hmm.
When you have, you know, members of his cabinet and that's any organization for that matter. You put a bunch of sycophants around you, a bunch of yes people, you do not get good outcomes. When I was the commander of the space shuttle, especially, I used to tell my shuttle crew members that they were required to question my decisions. It was not optional. And if you think we should be doing something differently, and especially if it affects safety and mission success, you have to tell me about it, and we're going to figure it out together.
You know,
I don't think Donald Trump has that, you know, an ounce of that instinct in his bones.
There's bigger things to talk about, but this jumped out to me, and I wanted to get your response. In the back and forth on social media, Secretary Hegseth put captain in quotes addressing you, almost mocking your military service. I'm wondering what your response to that from the Secretary of Defense was.
You know, he's a Twitter troll, right? You know, I take my job incredibly seriously. I'm a United States senator. I have accountability over the U.S. government. It's part of my responsibility. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I've been in hearing rooms with Secretary Hegseth before. He's not a serious person. I don't know what he meant by that. To be honest, I don't really care.
Yeah. We did get us and other outlets got some feedback from some retired officers saying this video wasn't needed. Everyone in the military knows this, that you know, you're saying something that's obvious to people in uniform. What's your response to that point of view?
Well, I'm not sure everybody in the military knows it. It's something that you're for me, at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, I may have heard once. I don't ever remember hearing it again. You know, we talk a little bit about the Geneva Conventions. I remember hearing that in SEER school. I think, you know, a friendly reminder about what the law is and that you're required to follow the law. We also wanted to show members of the military that we have their backs, mm-hmm. and that we understand the situation they might find themselves in.
Just real quick, we've got about 30 seconds left. What can you tell us about this FBI development from today? Have they given any justification for what an investigative scope would be, the reason for that?
I mean, we got something. Sergeant of Arms got something in an email.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking a look at it.
All right. Senator Mark Kelly, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
President Trump had set a deadline of Thursday for Ukraine to accept a deal to give up territory to Russia, including territory that Russia has not captured on the battlefield in almost 4 years of war. But now that deadline seems to be shifting and the terms of the deal changing. The White House says there's been, quote, tremendous progress in talks this week, but more negotiations are needed. NPR's Michelle Kellerman is here now to talk through some of this frenzied diplomacy. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there, Elsa.
Okay, so where do things stand right now?
Well, that deadline, as you mentioned, is slipping a bit. President Trump has said that he tends to extend deadlines if things are working out. And in this case, he says his team has been making progress. He's sending his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to meet with Vladimir Putin in Moscow. And his Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, who's a longtime friend of Vice President J.D. Vance, is also kind of playing an unusual diplomatic role here, too. Driscoll has been in Abu Dhabi, shuttling between Russian and Ukrainian delegations. Ukrainian officials have suggested that President Volodymyr Zelensky could come to the U.S. soon to finalize this deal with Trump. But Trump now says that he hopes to meet both Zelensky and Putin but only when a deal is closer. So pushing this off a little bit more.
Okay, it's been a little bit confusing because we have seen so many different views from this White House on Ukraine. Like, Trump berated Ukraine's president earlier this year, right, telling him he didn't hold any cards. And then a couple months ago, he said that he thought Ukraine could win back all of its territory. So I'm just wondering, like, how are people in Ukraine processing all of these mixed signals?
Yeah, it's kind of whiplash, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to an online discussion today hosted by the Atlantic Council, it's a Washington think tank, and I heard one expert, Leslie Shedd, say that she thinks the Ukrainian president has been pretty smart about this. Take a listen.
He is working very hard to try to figure out how to say yes to peace, how to say yes to what the president has offered. I think that that is smart because I bluntly think that there's going to be almost no deal that Putin will agree to.
And her view about Russian President Vladimir Putin was shared by other speakers in that panel, including Steve Biegun, who was Deputy Secretary of State during Trump's first term.
The reality is Putin doesn't want a ceasefire. Putin doesn't want a negotiation. Putin doesn't want peace. Putin wants Ukraine.
Biegun says it's a good thing that Trump wants an end to this war, but he says the U.S. really needs to be realistic about this and keep the pressure on Putin. But Trump, you know, really seems in a rush right now. He's also under a lot of pressure from some in his MAGA movement to focus more on home at home and to stop supporting Ukraine. And of course, Russia puts a lot of pressure back on him, too.
Right. And then over the weekend, a 28-point plan was leaked, and it called for Ukraine to give up territory. So do we know if that part has changed?
I mean, the one that was leaked read like a wish list for Russia. Some experts even suggested that it was part of a Russian disinformation campaign meant to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Europe. Trump says it was his plan. Secretary of State Marco Rubio also said that, and he rushed off to Geneva last weekend to sit down with the Ukrainians to put aside some of the more controversial points, like demands that were made of Western European allies. Rubio said he made some progress. The president says it's been fine-tuned. It seems to be a shorter deal on the table now, with more talk about, you know, a ceasefire along the current lines. But that's something that Trump proposed before, and Russia wasn't interested. So it's not really clear kind of what deal is going to emerge from this and whether Russia is going to agree to it. And I have to say, just to remind you, that the Russians throughout all of this have continued to carry out deadly drone and missile strikes on Ukraine, killing Ukrainian civilians, including children, and targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. And that's really another reason why U.S. officials say this needs to be solved quickly before another tough winter ahead of war.
Indeed. That is NPR's Michelle Kellerman speaking to us from the State Department. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Up next, Juana Summers speaks with Luke Goldstein of The Lever, who recently wrote about the rise of private equity control of youth hockey facilities across the U.S. We'll also hear the complex reasons behind why insurance premiums are going up. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region, 6 o'clock As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 o'clock tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Taking a look at our weather, most of the area under either a winter storm warning or winter weather advisory until noon tomorrow. Anywhere from 2 to 8 inches of snow possible. Looks like heavier amounts in northeastern and north central Minnesota, less in northwestern Minnesota, including the Bemidji area. Blustery northwest winds up to 40 miles per hour. Our lows tonight 18 to 22, and tomorrow snow tapering off by noon. Cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 20s, winds from the northwest again up to 30 miles per hour, and lows tomorrow night in the mid-teens, and for Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs near 24, again blustery northwest winds. KAXE's Cars program makes it quick and easy to get rid of an old car, truck, or boat. We will even tow it away for free. The proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for your favorite community radio station. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started or call Heather at 218-326-1234. Visit KAXE.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, plus info on community meals. If you have resources to add, email us, news@kaxe.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. If you have kids and they play sports, maybe you've been tempted to reach for that video camera in your pocket, which also makes phone calls, and maybe grab a little footage. About a year ago, a U.S. senator was warned about that.
I was just told this last weekend that if I live stream my child's hockey game, my kid's team will be penalized and lose a place in the standings. Why is that?
According to Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat, this is because a private equity company had bought up a bunch of ice rinks, installed video cameras in all of them, charged subscription fees to access their footage, and prohibited folks from filming their kids playing hockey. A new report from The Lever examines how restrictive streaming practices have become widespread in youth hockey and increasingly in many youth sports held at corporate-owned facilities. Luke Goldstein's article is headlined, Wall Street is paywalling your kids' sports. And Luke Goldstein is here in the studio with me now. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, Luke, I just want to start by asking you this. What Senator Chris Murphy had to say, is his description of this phenomenon accurate? How do these recording and streaming services work?
Yeah, so what I've kind of found from my reporting is that this is not just happening in youth hockey. Mm. This is really across the board. For youth sports in general, which has become a booming industry. It generates about $40 billion yeah. in revenue each year, according to an Aspen Institute study from earlier this year. And, you know, those kind of eye-popping numbers have attracted the interest of Wall Street firms and, in particular, private equity. And, you know, they've been buying up and, you know, rolling up a lot of these youth sports, you know, facilities, the leagues, tournaments. And, you know, that's leading to some pretty significant changes across the board. You know, one of the most dramatic changes is what's happened with the streaming services now. You're not allowed at numerous, you know, rinks and other kinds of sports facilities to record your own kids' okay. games. And you're offered this package that you can pay. And sometimes that will cost more than the streaming costs for professional sports like ESPN.
Luke, your article focuses largely on this one company that's called Black Bear Sports Group, and we reached out to them for comment, and a spokesperson told us, and I'm quoting here, parents are always welcome to record videos. They said that the only restrictions were on live streaming or broadcasting, citing safety and consent concerns. Does that square with what you heard in your reporting?
So before publishing the story, I had reached out to Black Bear Sports Group, and they had sent me, you know, a series of written responses. And prior to the publication of this article, did not dispute that parents were not allowed to record okay. and live stream and broadcast. After the publication of this article, they have put out a statement that the only policy is against live streaming the games, you know, online, on social media or other platforms. If you go to thelevernews.com and read the updated version of the story, I've actually obtained a contract between Black Bear's streaming service, Black Bear TV, and one of its affiliated rinks. And you'll see in the contract terms in plain language that it is not just banning the live streaming of games, it actually has language that prohibits recording devices. And
which could mean like your cell phone, then, I'm guessing.
It actually does say your phone as well. It says iPad. It has a long list of all kinds of equipment. But there is a clear stipulation in these contracts that the terms have to be enforced by rink owners.
In the statement that we got from Black Bear, they also said that their player participation rate of growth, it's more than double the national average. They point out that they have saved dozens of struggling ice rinks. And they also maintain that they're not owned by a private equity firm. What do you make of those remarks based on what you've learned?
My understanding is Black Bear Sports Group is a subsidiary of Blackstreet Capital, which is a private equity firm. And I think you can see also some parallels, you know, between the practices by both entities. Blackstreet is well known for buying up small, medium-sized companies that, you know, are distressed and have difficulties. Mm-hmm. They, you know, try to kind of make them a little bit leaner and then, you know, sell them off eventually. It's a very expensive business now to run an ice rink. Many of them have struggled and are on the verge of bankruptcy or closing up. So I think there's a much kind of longer story to tell of how Black Bear became the self-described largest ice hockey rink owner in the country. It's not just Black Bear. This is really a sea change that you're seeing across youth sports in general. Overall, what you're seeing here, because the costs of participating in youth sports across the board have gone up so dramatically, it is starting to cater to, frankly, just a wealthier customer base that's willing to pay top dollar for, you know, a higher quality streaming, you know, service that's being offered.
Luke Goldstein is an investigative journalist with The Lever News. Luke, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
People who buy their health insurance in the Obamacare marketplaces are facing huge price increases for the next year. That is because the federal government is set to contribute much less toward people's premiums. But why are those premiums so expensive to begin with? NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin explains.
The stories of what people are looking at for their premiums next year are staggering. For instance, why is it that a 64-year-old in West Virginia would have to pay $2,000 every month for an Affordable Care Act plan? Cynthia Cox with the nonpartisan health research organization KFF says it's pretty simple.
Obamacare insurance premiums are high because American health insurance premiums are high.
She says the premiums are actually about the same as employer health plans. It's just that in those plans, workers don't have to shoulder the whole cost. Cox says it's true that premiums were lower before the Affordable Care Act was passed. But back then, people with pre-existing conditions couldn't buy those plans at all, and they often didn't cover very much.
For example, health plans often might not cover pregnancy or even prescription drugs.
Okay, so health plans now cover more people and more things, but it still seems like a lot of money for coverage, much more than people pay in other countries.
I think it's a common misunderstanding that health insurance profits are what drives healthcare costs.
Perhaps surprisingly, Americans pay more for health insurance than people in other countries, mostly because our hospitals and doctors charge more.
A hospital visit in the United States costs more. A doctor's visit costs more. The same prescription drug costs more.
She says it's not like Americans are going to the doctor or having longer hospital stays. In fact,
we have slightly fewer doctor's visits and slightly shorter hospital stays than people in similarly large and wealthy countries do. But we are just paying higher prices for that care that we get.
For the last few years, the 24 million people who buy their own insurance have been shielded from some of these high costs. These small business owners and farmers and ranchers have had access to these comprehensive health plans while only paying part of the premium costs, with taxpayers paying the rest. Kind of like employees of big businesses pay part of their premiums and companies pay the rest. Now, that federal financial help is shrinking unless Congress works out a bipartisan deal in the next few weeks. People have until December 15th to pick a plan that begins in the new year. Lawmakers are currently home for the Thanksgiving holiday. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Winter storm warning continues until noon tomorrow. 2 to 8 inches of snow possible throughout the region. Winds gusting up to 35 miles per hour. Slippery road conditions are expected. Do be careful out there.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Crow Wing County Attorney's Office has charged a Cross Lake couple with 10 tax-related felonies each. The Minnesota Department of Revenue announced the charges in a news release on Tuesday. Brian and Paulina Schindel each face 4 felony counts of filing false or fraudulent income tax returns and 6 felony counts of failing to file sales tax returns. The complaints state that despite receiving more than 65 letters regarding their tax status, the Schindels misrepresented their taxable income on their income tax returns. They underreported or didn't report income from multiple businesses and short-term rental properties for tax years 2019 through 2022. The complaints further state that the Schindels also failed to file sales tax returns for their furniture building business, Timber Creek Productions, and their interior design business, Donick Design Group, LLC. They allegedly failed to file sales tax returns for the rental payments for their 2 short-term rental properties located in Crow Wing County. According to the complaints, the Schindels owe over $98,000 in sales and income tax penalties and interest. Reed Olson of Bemidji has announced he will run for office again in 2026. The executive director of the Nameless Coalition for the Homeless and former Beltrami County Commissioner announced on social media that he will seek to represent District 2A.
A lot of us are feeling the squeeze. Almost every family in north central Minnesota is feeling pressure either from the rising cost of housing, the insane increase in insurance premiums that so many of us are facing, or just a struggle for you or your family to access mental health care or child care.
The race could be a rematch between Olson, a DFLer, and Representative Badal Duran, a Republican, if Duran announces a bid for re-election. The two faced off for the open seat in 2024 after the retirement of former Republican Representative Matt Grossel. While Duran was victorious, the race represented one of the smallest margins of victory for a Republican in a state House race in northern Minnesota. Duran garnered 51.7% of the vote, while Olson came up just short of 48%. Olson says he believes affordability is more than just a buzzword.
It's time to put affordability and access to quality care at the center of the work that we do.
The 2026 election will see all Minnesota House seats on the ballot. A popular attraction at a North Shore State Park reopened on Monday. The High Falls Pedestrian Bridge spans the Baptism River at Teteguch State Park. The previous bridge was built in 1988 and closed in 2022 after severe flood damage. Another round of severe flooding last year fully detached the bridge on one side. While the bridge was closed, Superior Hiking Trail through hikers had to take a detour. The new High Falls Bridge is 5 feet taller to make it more resilient to high flooding. The bridge replacement was part of a $1 million construction project. Several areas that were also closed during construction have also reopened, including the High Falls Trailhead parking lot, the group camp, the nature play area, and multiple hiking trails on the west side of the river. A new initiative from the State Board of Water and Soil Resources aims to protect lakes from winter recreation pollution. The Aiken, Beltrami, Cass, Crow Wing, and Lake of the Woods Soil and Water Conservation Districts were awarded Keep It Clean grants from the state. The program's goal is to protect lakes by preventing and cleaning up garbage and waste left on the ice in the winter. The grants ranged from $25,000 to $40,000, and the money will go toward activities like ice cleanup events, plus education and outreach. The Beltrami County Historical Society is looking for community members to help shape its new exhibit. The organization received a private grant to redesign its permanent galleries at the Historic Depot in Bemidji. The new exhibit will focus on interactive, family-friendly spaces that honor the diverse stories that shape the region. 10 to 12 community members will serve on an advisory committee to provide input on themes, community relevance, accessibility, and more. The Historical Society is looking for people from a variety of backgrounds, including Dakota and Ojibwe cultural knowledge keepers, local historians, business and civic leaders, subject matter experts, educators, and advocates. Applications are open through Sunday. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXC News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, in select theaters Wednesday, everywhere December 5th. From Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Israel has blocked all independent press access to Gaza since the war began in 2023, meaning almost all on-the-ground reporting has come from Palestinian journalists who are already in Gaza, journalists who are living through the war themselves, including NPR's own Anas Baba. International journalists have been fighting for access for more than 2 years, and earlier this week, Israel's Supreme Court prolonged that wait yet again. Here to tell us more about that is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Hi, Kat.
Hey there.
So can you just catch us up on this case that's been before the Supreme Court in Israel?
Yeah, when the war first started, Israel immediately closed the borders to Gaza to all press access, citing security concerns for both Israeli troops and journalists themselves. The Foreign Press Association here in Israel, of which NPR is a member, filed a petition with the Supreme Court pretty soon after that, arguing for access. The court rejected that petition, but the FPA filed again last year. And since then, there have been numerous postponements. Yesterday, the court granted yet another extension to the State of Israel.
Okay. And just to be clear, you have been reporting on this war almost since it started. Have you ever been in Gaza?
No, I haven't. But of course, we have Anas there, like you said. Pretty much the only access outside journalists, including Israeli journalists, have been allowed into Gaza is on highly controlled, very selective embeds with the Israeli military. And many outlets, including NPR, have gone on those. Essentially, some access is better than no access. But they are in no way whatsoever a replacement for independent reporting. The Israeli military controls what you see, who you talk to, and also requires that they be allowed to go through all of your footage and tape afterward. But Elsa, it hasn't been like this in past Gaza wars. Here's Joe Fetterman. He's Associated Press's news director for the region and also the deputy chair of the FPA here. He told me this is the fifth war in Gaza that he's covered, and there have never been delays like this.
Even the longest war, which was 2014, we were able to work out a system to get people in and out while the war was still going on.
So because of these current restrictions, as we've been saying, Anas Baba, our colleague, has been almost individually, solely responsible for so much of our coverage coming out of Gaza.
Right, exactly. It's been kind of shocking to me that more of the American public doesn't seem to be aware of the media ban into Gaza. And I think a large part of that is because we've had such excellent nonstop work coming from our Palestinian colleagues there. Having other press access isn't to replace that reporting, it's to supplement it. The Palestinian journalists in Gaza, Anas included, are covering this war relentlessly while living through it, losing their homes, struggling to find food, seeing friends, family, and colleagues, many colleagues killed. And they can't leave. They can't take a break. You know, I talk to Anas almost every day while I'm out here, and we've never met. I can't go to him, and he certainly can't come here to me.
That's just so incredible to me that the two of you have never actually met. It is incredibly dangerous in Gaza, of course, which is one of the reasons that Israel cites for not allowing the press. But Kat, how often do we see these kinds of absolute restrictions on international independent media during wartime?
It's rare. I mean, in any war zone, there are always restrictions or censorship. But, you know, I've covered Russia's war in Ukraine as well, and there you can get fairly close to the front lines. You can talk to the people most affected by the violence, and you can see the destruction with your own eyes. You know, Israel has asserted many times that the justification is for security purposes, but critics of that, including critics here in Israel, have argued that it's Israel's attempt to not have more credible journalists seen firsthand the level of destruction and the horrors of this war.
That is NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene recently announced that she is stepping down from her seat midterm. Her last day in office will be January 5th. The decision came after a simmering feud between Representative Greene and President Trump over the Epstein files and other issues. Greene, of course, rose to national fame as a staunch backer of Trump and the MAGA movement. But in recent weeks, Trump revoked his endorsement of her. Greene said that she did not want her district to have to endure a, quote, hateful primary. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Sarah Collis traveled to Greene's Northwest Georgia district after she announced her resignation to see what her constituents had to say. Sarah, thanks for being on the line.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious, what was the mood like in the district?
Well, it's safe to say that people were shocked by her announcement. I noticed that people were very hesitant to talk to press. I actually went up to her district 2 days before she announced her resignation as well. And when I went up then, constituents were coming up to me. They wanted to give their opinion and their name. But this time when I went up, very few people wanted to talk, and even fewer wanted to give a name or any identifying information. Some of them said they were worried about family backlash, especially with the upcoming holiday.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about what the people who did talk to you said, though.
Well, again, folks were definitely very surprised, and it's important to note here that she's very popular in her district. They voted overwhelmingly for both her and President Trump in 2024. Here's Floyd Farless from Rome, which is Greene's hometown, who said he voted for her last year.
I wish she had not done it at this situation. It does leave us without representation until somebody is appointed. She has been somewhat of a firebrand, but every area's got their own. And she would have been reelected for sure here. I don't think any question about it.
And it's important to note here that Farless used the word appointed, but that seat will actually be vacant until a special election is called when voters will select a new representative and they are sworn in.
Curious what else you heard from voters.
Well, constituents represented a pretty wide range of opinions. You know, some said that they support her doing what she needs to do. They had some theories that she might be concerned about her personal safety. And then there were some others that echoed Farless's concerns, especially about the lack of representation in Congress in between that period where she resigns and the special election happens to replace her. And that likely would be sometime in February. And some constituents also cited some unfounded conspiracy theories about her resignation, which include some claims that the Democratic Party undermined her. And it's important to note here that Greene rose to prominence for pushing conspiracy theories like QAnon when she first ran in 2020.
So that's voters. What about local Republican Party leaders?
So the GOP chair for Greene's district, Jackie Harling, said that she was shocked and saddened as well, which definitely seems to be the theme here, but she understands her decision ultimately.
I do not blame her for making the choice to basically jump out of the torture chamber. When your family is threatened, it's a whole different ball of wax.
Greene has said that she's received death threats throughout her time in Congress. And Harling says that she still fully supports President Trump, but she also told me that the rift between Trump and Greene has been pretty difficult for her.
I still support him. I am a big believer in showing grace and forgiveness.
And now attention for Harling and the district GOP is turning to the special election that's going to happen early next year.
What else can you tell us about that campaign? It's in its early days.
Well, it's the most conservative district in Georgia, and there won't be a primary because of Georgia laws, so a crowded field is definitely possible in this race with candidates on both sides of the aisle. And if no one gets that 50% of the vote, it's going to have to go to a runoff, which would leave the district without representation in Washington for even longer. And Congressman Greene said on social media that she's not going to endorse in this race. But Trump has been pretty active in endorsements in congressional races, so it's possible he'll endorse here.
That is Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sarah Callis. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has launched a campaign against the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. He has declared that the Muslim Civil Rights Group is a foreign terrorist organization. The key question is, can he do that, legally speaking? And if so, under what authority? Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports on how this development is affecting more than 300,000 Muslims in Texas.
Syed Al-Ferdis attends services at the Maryam Islamic Center in Sugar Land, southwest of Houston, every evening. Al-Ferdis says Governor Abbott's calling CARE a terrorist organization shows a lack of education about Islam.
I think it's very juvenile, to say the least. It's very immature, and it just doesn't hold any water.
Abbott used a 2023 Texas law to brand CARE a foreign terrorist organization. He accused CARE of trying to, quote, forcibly impose Sharia law, and he ordered the Texas Department of Public Safety to launch criminal investigations of it.
What does a civil rights organization in United States, incorporated in United States, run by American citizens, got to do with a foreign entity?
That's a question Kenneth Williams, who teaches constitutional and civil rights law at Texas Tech University, says cuts directly to the heart of whether Abbott has the authority to go after CARE.
If they're not operating outside the United States, and it would seem like this designation is illegal and not authorized under the statute.
Declaring an entity a foreign terrorist organization is exclusively the purview of the U.S. State Department. Williams is also concerned that Abbott is violating Muslims' First Amendment rights.
If the governor is allowed to proceed against this organization, there's a possibility that the governor could also proceed against other organizations with which the governor does not approve.
That's CARE's argument as well. It's suing Abbott for what it says is the fourth time. Edward Ahmed Mitchell is CARE's national deputy director.
This lawsuit argues that Governor Abbott has violated due process, violated the First Amendment, and also misused Texas law in order to silence dissent in violation of the Constitution.
Abbott has been targeting Muslim organizations in Texas for months. Earlier this year, he sued to stop a proposed Muslim housing development in the Dallas area, accusing it of trying to impose Sharia law. Several investigations are still ongoing. CARE says Muslims may look to Sharia law for personal religious practice, but Sharia does not override U.S. or state law. Mitchell says Abbott's actions are endangering CARE's employees and Texas Muslims in general.
Our staff in Texas had to receive security protection from Texas law enforcement because an anti-Muslim extremist showed up at a public hearing and demanded to know where the CARE officials were. He was hunting down CARE officials.
We contacted Abbott's office multiple times, but no one from the office would speak on the record. Mark Jones is a political scientist at Rice University's Baker Institute. He says Abbott is responding to pressure from some Texas Republicans concerned about the growth of Islam in the state.
They look to places like Minneapolis, where a growing Muslim population has resulted in calls to prayer being broadcast on loudspeakers. And what they view as a Christian way of life is being eroded.
Jones says those Texas Republicans tend to view their state and the country as essentially Judeo-Christian, rather than a place where many faiths can coexist. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also sample our album of the week. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host. She'll bring you a great mix of music. And at 10 o'clock, it's Headwaters with Malachi Coons. And in the 11 o'clock hour, a conversation with Dave Simonette. He will be in concert at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids this Saturday. Programming on KAXE is supported by the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. And we thank the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to those who will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. We have a winter storm warning in effect until noon tomorrow with 2 to 8 inches of snow possible. Winds will gust up to 35 miles per hour. Slippery road conditions are expected. Our lows tonight, 18 to 22. Snow tapering off in the morning tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 20s. Northwest winds again up to 35 miles per hour. For Thanksgiving Day, mostly cloudy, highs near 24. Those blustery northwest winds will persist. Downtown Walker invites you to a Festival of Lights on Friday with a parade at 5 o'clock and a tree lighting at 6. Activities continue on Saturday with a kids' open house at Walker Bay Theater from 11 to 3. Let us know what's happening in your community. You can send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. We continue now with All Things Considered.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. What powers the global internet? The answer might surprise you. It's not satellites, but hundreds of thin cables that run along the ocean floor. The roots of this crucial and often fragile oceanic infrastructure date all the way back to the mid-1800s. Throughline's Ramtin Arablouei brings us the story of the man who created the first transatlantic cable, laying the foundations for today's global communications.
In the 1850s, if you wanted to send a letter across the Atlantic Ocean, say from New York to London, it would take about 2 weeks, and then you'd have to wait another 2 weeks for a reply. 1 month for just one exchange. But that would all change because of one bored and wealthy man, Cyrus Field.
I gather he was about 5'9", which may have been on the slightly tall side. Also estimated 140 pounds or so. My name is Cyrus W. Field IV.
Yes, Cyrus Field IV. He is the great-great-grandson of the first Cyrus Field that we're talking about.
He was extremely squirmy and always running around, very high energy. He was bright. He was good at math. At age 12, he started keeping the family books, running the finances for the family. And he was the only boy in that family that didn't go to college.
Cyrus moved to New York from Massachusetts as a teenager and started working at a paper company. Eventually, he started his own company and made a fortune, the equivalent of about $10 million today.
And apparently he worked all the time except on Sundays. But it took a toll on his health. And after something like 14 years, I guess, in the paper business, his doctor told him he needed to retire.
Which he did.
And was apparently kind of bored.
Until the day a stranger came knocking at his door. The stranger was an engineer who wanted Cyrus to invest in a telegraph cable to improve communications between Newfoundland in eastern Canada and the North American mainland. But Cyrus had a better idea.
And he had a big floor globe, which is now in the Smithsonian. And Cyrus says, well, you know, if we're going to have a connection to Newfoundland, why couldn't we just extend it across the Atlantic?
A transatlantic cable. It had never been done before, and nobody had even attempted to do it. But if this idea was possible, it would be weeks faster than having a mail ship cross the Atlantic.
And so Cy looks at his globe and says, why don't we do a cable?
The idea was to have a cable line that would connect from the west coast of Ireland all the way to Newfoundland in Canada. From there, telegraph landlines would carry messages onto major cities like New York and London.
Now, Cyrus is not technical. He's in the paper business.
This is Bill Burns.
I'm a former BBC broadcast engineer.
And he's the founder of the website Atlantic-Cable.com, which is a deep dive, so to speak, on the first transatlantic cable.
But he's not technical at all, but he has friends who are, like Samuel Morse, for example.
No big deal, just the inventor of the revolutionary telegraph and the Morse code. So Cyrus talks to those friends, pours a bunch of money into the project, gets investors on board, and even gets two warships from the U.S. and the British government that would each carry 1,000 miles of cable. This would be a crucial part of the plan, as no single ship could carry the cable's full weight. It would take at least 30 men to coil cables onto a ship at any given moment.
And it's a copper wire with 7 strands that is surrounded by gutta percha, which is a tree resin, and then surrounding that is iron wire stranded around it for strength and protection.
The whole thing was around 5/8 of an inch in diameter. That's smaller than a dime. And the plan is to drop it all 12,000 feet down to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Cyrus makes all the necessary preparations, crew members, machinery, food, and water for the journey.
So here we are in the summer of 1857.
The plan was for the first ship to lay its 1,000 miles of cable, meet the second ship in the middle of the ocean, splice the cables together, and let the other ship finish laying the rest. But almost as quickly as they started,
they ran into problems with their machinery. They got about 350 miles out from Ireland, and they lost the end of the cable in much deeper water, and they could not recover the cable. And the problem was then, they really had very little slack on the cable, not enough to replace 350 miles that was lost. So they gave up for the year.
A year after the first try, they make a second attempt. But again, it fails because of a massive storm that ends up damaging the cables on board. But just a month after that second attempt, Cyrus and the two warships head back out to sea.
And they start again in the middle, and they sail out to both ends.
A day passes, then two.
They both land at about the same time, and they land the cables, and they start sending signals.
They had done it.
The Queen desires to congratulate the President upon the successful completion of this great international work.
The Queen of England sends the first official message to the President of the United States. It's 102 words and takes almost 16 hours to send. But it's way better than 2 weeks. And when Cyrus returns to New York City, he gets a hero's welcome.
They have a big celebration in Manhattan with fireworks and parades.
And the cable starts to deliver on its promise. Hundreds of messages go back and forth. Within a decade, the transatlantic cable is on its way to becoming indispensable.
So for $100 in gold, in 1866, you could send a 20-word message across the cable. Bring that into modern money, it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars, you know, for a single message.
Which is phenomenally expensive, but it beats, you know, boating across the ocean ever.
As for Cyrus Field, the project he spent over a decade on, invested his own fortune in, that he believed in with his whole being, was finally finished. He could finally give his mind and body some rest.
Apparently, he crossed the Atlantic over 50 times dealing with this, and he got seasick every time.
By 1900, cables connected almost every continent.
If you look at a present-day cable map of the world, and you look at the 1902 cable map of the world, you will see those cables are on exactly the same routes, okay, worldwide, with the exception of the Pacific, which is much more heavily cabled now.
In the 1950s, the first telephone cables were laid in the ocean, and fiber optic cables followed starting in the 1980s. Today, hundreds of undersea cables keep billions of people connected.
That was Throughline's Ramtin Arablouei. You can hear the whole episode on NPR's Throughline podcast.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. online at WTGrantFoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much. I'm Jennifer Barr, coming up next, As It Happens. Snow tonight with 3 to 7 inches possible in northeastern and north central Minnesota. Less snow in northwestern Minnesota, 1 to 2 inches there. Blustery northwest winds, 15 to 40 miles per hour. Lows 18 to 22. Chance of snow tomorrow before noon, cloudy, highs in the mid to upper 20s.